Thank you. Good afternoon. I'd like to thank the Washington Institute and Dr. Satloff and Mr. Makovsky for inviting us here. It's an honor and a pleasure to speak at this institute. I think it is also a time to reflect on Zev Schiff. He was your friend and colleague, and he passed away almost a year ago. To me, Zev was a constant source of wisdom and advice for many years, a man of great intellect and generosity, and he is deeply missed. It's been almost 2 years since the war in Lebanon, and I think the balance is far from being positive from an Israeli point of view. But we should look at it carefully and understand that there are traces of gray, and it's not only black or white. I'd start with what I see as a major question, the question of deterrence. And I'd have to say that I'm less bothered than some about the consequences for Israel from this war. Everything I say when we're concerned with the Middle East is true for this moment. It might change completely in a few days or weeks, but the way it seems right now, I feel that although the IDF's ground forces have performed quite disappointingly during the war, I feel that it's I doubt if the Israeli army's image is as bad as some might perceive. I think the best example for that is not the war itself, but two events that happened in the following year and a half after the war. The first, of course, is the Israeli Air Force attack on that nuclear reactor in Syria in September 6th of 2007. The second being that mysterious bomb exploding in Damascus and killing Imad Mounia, Hezbollah's top terrorist last February. Israel, of course, has not claimed any responsibility for that second incident, but both Iran, Hezbollah, and Syria do blame Israel. The fact is that there was no response from the Syrian side, and I think there's a very large difference between President Assad's threats after the war and the way he behaved after that attack, especially the first attack, the Air Force attack last September. Now, we don't know exactly what happened at those early morning hours after the bombing of the nuclear reactor. I can tell you that from what I know right now, the war intelligence officers in the Israeli military who felt that there was indeed a danger of immediate Syrian retaliation. Now, this did not happen. We can only assume why Assad did not react. From my point of view, I would guess that he had watched carefully what happened during the war, and he did not necessarily reach the same conclusions as the Israeli media or Israeli politicians. Because what President Assad saw was an air force who could strike at the first day of the war in Lebanon and hit very precisely, a pinpoint operation, hit very precisely at houses where Hezbollah kept its medium-range rockets. It had the intelligence, it had the capability of attacking. He saw the Air Force destroying Hezbollah's headquarters in the Dahya, in the southern quarter of Beirut. He was aware of the debate inside Israel about the possibility of hitting Lebanese infrastructure during the war. It didn't happen because of an American veto, but he was probably aware of the fact that Israel would not be under such limitations if a war broke with Syria. And he was probably under the very hard impression of the actual attack. Again, Israel having the intelligence to strike, attacking a project which was supremely confidential in Syrian eyes. Probably some of his top senior military officers didn't even know that this existed. And again, Israel succeeded in that. A few words about the war itself. I feel like the story itself, you know, and also most of the main details. But Avi and myself, we feel we do not see the war as a total mistake. We do not feel that the Israeli decision to attack, to respond to that abduction of the two soldiers in July 12th of 2006 was a mistake. But we do feel there was a justification for so that it was justified to react. But the war could have ended after 3 or 4 days in terms that were more than reasonable for Israel. And what we suspect is that Israel did not understand the limitations of what it can actually achieve. The decision made was not to end the war, and instead we saw 3 or 4 more weeks of more of the same, more air force being used without hitting infrastructure. As we said, the Americans would not let Israel do that because of the implications on Senora's government, with no real answer, tactical, it became strategic in a way, answer to the Katyusha short-range rockets, and without taking what many in Israel perceive as the only possible course of action if you decide to go on, which is sending the ground troops in. Then later on, after four weeks of fighting, when it was pretty evident that the war should end and that Israel should cut its losses and finish the war, there was a last-ditch attempt of sending the ground troops in, and it was a very classic case of too little, too late. Perhaps more importantly for what we deal with right now is the fact that this war is the first war that has exposed how volatile, how vulnerable the Israeli home front is. And the meaning of this, of course, is that our home front, our civilian population, could be under attack again if another war starts, whether it's with Syria, Hezbollah, Iran, and we are under our southern border with the Gaza Strip is under constant bombardment by Qassam rockets and mortar fire. Two other important lessons that I take from the war has to do with what I should call probably civilian surveillance of the army. The government needs to keep a much more watchful eye over the military to understand its limitations, to understand what it can and couldn't do, and preferably also to understand when it decides on a war that it is actually a war and that there are implications for that. After the war, there was a very big debate in Israel, and most of it became political. After around the Vinograd report, its interim report in the beginning, who's going to take the blame? Well, some people did, some will probably take the blame soon, maybe too late. But what I feel is more important is the third lesson, and that is the disappointing performance of the IDF's ground forces during the war and the reasons for that. I think that it's about a process. This is not something that happened overnight. As a reporter, as a journalist, I was aware of some of this process going on, but I didn't understand the full implications of that. And it has to do mostly with practice, training, and preparedness. Now, the key event we discussed is July 11th of 2006, a day before the war broke, a day before the abduction. Prime Minister Olmert and Defense Minister Peretz come and visit the general headquarters of the IDF for the first time, and they have a talk with the generals. And surprisingly enough, some of the senior officers are pretty open about the IDF's deficiencies. One general in particular, his name is General Lishai Ber, stands and talks to both the Prime Minister and the Defense Minister, and he says tough words. He said, the IDF has turned into a mediocre army. There are islands of excellence, but they are surrounded by a big sea of mediocrity. He speaks of General Baer speaks of the damages that are brought about by the fact that the IDF is serving so much time, is so busy fighting terrorists and Palestinian Intifada in the territories. But he's mainly talking about what happened with the training. He said this is a one-of-a-kind Israeli invention, an army that does not practice. He said it's like a bouncing check. One day the phone call from the bank is going to arrive. Chief of Staff Chalutz interferes in the end, and he says, although to Olmert, you've heard the tough things being said here, but I can promise you that the IDF will perform exceptionally well with any challenge. This, of course, the day afterwards was put on, it was tested, and I think the results weren't as one could have hoped from the Israeli side. Why did this happen? I think, first of all, it happened because of losing professional knowledge. The change happened in the year 2000 when the Intifada broke, the second Intifada. The focus of the IDF, of the country at large, was in the West Bank mostly. And when we talk of the IDF's relative failure in the war in Lebanon, we must also acknowledge that it had a very big success fighting Palestinian terrorism in the West Bank. It was not only the IDF, it was the Shin Bet, the security services providing all this intelligence, but we've gotten terrorism down from 450 Israelis who were killed in such attacks in 2002 to 15 killed in 2007. And this is something, it's not a decisive victory. You're all familiar with the debate over is it possible to reach such a victory in asymmetric warfare, but it's as close as anybody got in the last 50 years since the British in Malaya. On the other hand, this meant that you needed lots of energy, lots of troops, lots of money being put inside this conflict. And we were facing, again, we must remember, facing terrorist suicide bombers coming every day to our towns in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Anybody who's visited these towns at those times remembers how afraid people were, how frightening this was just to walk on the street of Israeli town. Apart from that, there were reasons that had to do with the budget, not enough money for practice because so much money was spent on fighting terrorism. There was a school of thought, especially after the war in Iraq, that the Eastern Front is over with. Syria cannot achieve any kind of cooperation of the Iraqis or anybody else, that the days, that the era of conventional warfare are over, and this is why the IDF should not practice as much and should concentrate on the real challenge, which was the war in the territories. The result of this was that when the war started, you had regular units who did not practice for years, practicing for 3 or 4 weeks at a time in a year. You had a division's commander's course that was canceled because there was no time to do that. We spoke to soldiers and officers who actually fought in the war. There is a famous battle during the war in August of 2006, in the last few days. It was called the Saluki battle. It was an important part of the war. And I've talked to the battalion commander of the tanks that were actually sent in that last ditch attempt. And I asked him, when did you practice before? And he started giving me a list of the different places they were at the 18 months that he commanded the battalion before. I think they practiced for a few weeks. Other than that, those soldiers did not see their tanks. And of course, with the reserve units, it was even more crucial. But on the other hand, there was a very deep process of denial of the army, because it was doing so well fighting Palestinian threat from the West Bank that people did not like to talk too much about what we were missing. And you know how this works in these kind of organizations. You're usually you're used to telling the people higher up in the chain of command that everything is working okay. You don't want to say too much about the fact that you might not be too prepared to other missions. On top of that, we had a government who was not too experienced in such issues. Ariel Sharon, of course, suffered a stroke in January of 2006. He was replaced by Olmert. Amir Peretz, with no military experience as a defense minister. And new chief of staff, a man of great achievements in the Air Force, but with no experience in ground warfare. And we saw the results in Lebanon. We saw those battalion commanders meeting the soldiers in fighting, not for the first time, but actually with facing such challenges that they haven't practiced for years. there was also an issue of values, one might say. There was no sense of urgency because there was no understanding, both in the military and the government, of how severe the threat to the home front was. And therefore, when at last ground forces were sent in, they were sent bit by bit, step by step, with no real direct orders to deal with Katyushas, on the one hand, and with no sense of urgency, with no time limit. They had the time. It was like fighting terrorism in the West Bank, without a deep understanding of what was going on the home front. We spoke to a lot of the generals and the officers, the brigade commanders and the battalion commanders and so on, who took part in the war. And sometimes I felt like it was interviewing people who were hurt in a traffic accident. There were deep feelings of frustration, of remorse, of people taking responsibility for what has happened. I saw nobody who treated this lightly on the military side in Israel. I'm sorry to say I can't say the same about our politicians. But in a way, the army in those months after the war was an army suffering from post-trauma. Defense Minister Barak, who of course got into his replaced Peretz by June of 2007, is very, very clear about that. Barak portrays the war, of course he was not part of it, as a total failure. I think he exaggerates a little, but one has to face some of the facts. Looking at the balance, Avi will deal with this much more deeply than I will, but Hezbollah is rather strong now. It has its influence in Beirut. It has more than 40,000 rockets. These are the last assessments on the Israeli side, which is triple the number it had before the war, and those rockets now are able to reach the southern parts of Israel. These are areas that were not reached by the rockets held before the war. It does not have outposts along the fence, along the border with Israel, which is an advantage for Israel, because these outposts serve as a sort of a base of operations for attacks like the hijacking. But I don't think that something has deeply changed in the balance between Israel and Hezbollah, especially not to our advantage. How does the IDF look right now? I think the main narrative is recovery. We have a new chief of staff. He's very tough. He's very demanding of his officers. The lights remain on until the late hours of every day. The army practices all the time. There's a trend of going back to the old values. And Chief of Staff Ashkenazi is fond of saying that he knows only two situations for an army to function in. One is preparing for a war, and the other is fighting it. And he also said in many occasions that he doesn't want a war to start, but if it does, he wants to make sure, under his term, he wants to make sure that nobody would ask who won by the time the war ends. Some of the problems have remained. There's always the question, are we in fact preparing for the right war? Is the next war going to be anything like what we faced in 2006? I see a sort of what I call a strategy of more. It's pretty easy for the government. What exactly do you want? You need more weapons, more money, we'll give it to you. Is that spent in the right direction? I'm not sure that it's always discussed extensively enough between the military and the government. And there are other questions that bother me. A major one, I've mentioned the threat on the home front in Israel. When Ashkenazi speaks of the importance of winning decisively, this means that if a war starts and we know that there is a possibility, and we know that if fighting indeed occurs, we will see rockets pointed again at our shot at our military, at our civilian population. This means that in a short time, the army has to decide which is more important: achieving victory by attacking ground forces, for instance, in the Golan Heights, if a war starts with Syria, or defending civilian population by attacking all those missiles before they're shot at us. And I'm not sure that the IDF can do both at the same time. This will be a very heavy dilemma, and I think that Israel will pay a price if a war starts. And when talking to IDF intelligence officers, most of them feel that if another war occurs, then we will be facing thousands of rockets from different directions, not only Hamas, but Hezbollah, not only Hezbollah, but maybe even Syria. It is not one front anymore, different fronts anymore. It's actually one front divided in different directions. About the army itself, I think that there is a very clear improvement. I see a certain damage to morale among officers because of what went on during the war, but on the other hand, I see a clear understanding of what lays ahead. It's very clear, for instance, with the pilots. More and more pilots and navigators are willing to sign on for more military service because they understand the situation is grave and the challenges are big and that the Air Force will play a very major part in this. I want to end on a personal note. I know that journalists perhaps are not supposed to be too involved in what they cover. It's thought of to be better to be detached from what was going on. But Avi and I, we followed the war quite closely, and I have to say that it was a frustrating experience, and I couldn't help but taking it personally sometimes. And the general opinion is in Israel was that we should have performed better. Those of you who knew Ze'ev closely knew that Ze'ev felt the same way. I actually suspected in the last months before he died that he took it to his health, that he was really that bothered. I think David would agree with me with what happened, with the consequences, with what this means for the IDF and for Israel later on. I saw the Prime Minister's speech, Prime Minister Olmert's speech at the APAC conference yesterday. It was a very impressive speech. I think no Israeli Prime Minister would have done it better, but I couldn't help but think that there was a certain amount of poetic justice, if you like, in what's going on right now, because Olmert, it's very clear, is on his way out, and his political career seems to be over. It happens because of the latest corruption scandal, but in my personal opinion is that perhaps what should have happened in August of 2006 will now happen in August of 2008. Thank you.